everyone. I'm Liz. I'm an alcoholic. And my sobriety date is May 8th, 2006. And I want to thank Billy for asking me to come out and speak. I really like it out here. It's just so pretty. And I came out here with my husband, and we were just saying in the car how it's like the farther you get away from the mass metropolitan area of D.C., the easier it is to breathe. But so, you know, immediately I'm like, oh, we could live out here, it'd be so awesome. But no, that's just outside things trying to fix me again. But I really do like it here. So thanks for asking me to come out. But this is the most time I've ever had to speak in front of people. So, and I've prayed to be honest, and so we'll see what happens. I have about 50 minutes, so we'll see. But I told you my sobriety date. I have a home group. I have a sponsor. And those are three things that really help keep me grounded in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I don't know if anyone's new tonight. When I was new, I thought AA was like my death sentence. It was certainly the last place I was going to turn. And I didn't even really turn there. I just had nowhere else to look, really. You know, I thought, you know, when I got out of rehab, my life was going to be miserable, and there, you know, there's no more having fun. And that has absolutely not been the case. Because of this program, I have a fuller life than I've ever had before, inside and out. Certainly the outside things, but I have this, this peace inside that I've never been able to get before, other than, you know, playing music, playing sports, or drinking. You know, now I have the ability to have that with me, you know, more often than not nowadays. But I grew up in California, and I lived in, if you've ever watched the Wonder Years, that was kind of the neighborhood I lived in. It was, you know, suburban California. I had friends that lived around the corner from me, and I, you know, played with them after school. And I had, when I was in rehab, I'm like, there's got to be some reason, you know, some reason for me to, you know, drink like I do. And I really couldn't find anything from my childhood. And the best I could come up with is my parents liked to drink. I mean, it was really pathetic. But, you know, I had a nice childhood, but you know, I was really involved in things like I mentioned, like music and sports, and those things really helped me looking back. And I can tell you in retrospect, I wouldn't have said this at the time, but I was very much comparing myself against other people. And there's this part, I think it's in the fourth step of the 12 and 12, because I was reading it recently, but there's this part where it talks about this lack of ability we have to form real relationships with people. And I have that now in AA. I'd never had anything like that before, you know, but my friends, I always felt like I just couldn't measure up, or that we were on some secret competitive level that I was the only one keeping track. I was very much a scorekeeper, and I just, you know, there was something, some invisible thing between me and, you know, even my best friends growing up. I was always competitive with them in my head, and it just made me not be able to connect to them. And, you know, if they did something nice for me out of the, you know, genuine niceness of themselves, I would feel like a, you know, piece of poo until I did something nice for them, because I had to, because, you know, now they have 1 point and I have zero. I mean, that was just how I thought. And you know, so I just didn't have that ability to have real human connections with people. And I didn't realize that at the time. I mean, the one, you know, the times where I didn't feel like that was, like I said, when I was playing sports. I mean, I loved playing sports. You know, I feel like I say that all the time, but you guys haven't heard it before. But you know, like when I was, you know, out on the court or out on the field or doing whatever, it finally didn't matter what anyone thought of me unless I screwed up, you know, or it didn't matter like what I looked like doing certain things, or did I just say something funny, or was that awkward? I mean, I was just out there doing a job, and we all had the same, you know, singleness of purpose, and I loved that. And, you know, the reason I always bring that up is because I'm the only one in my family who likes sports, and I'd always wondered why that was, and somebody mentioned it in telling their story at a meeting, and I had this big, like, click moment, because that truly was, before drinking, the thing that best got me out of my head. And it was very much like drinking. You know, when you're drinking, everyone's best friends, and, you know, you're all buddies, and everything's okay. And it felt like that when I was playing sports, but then when you're done drinking, it's the next day. It's, for me, anyway, it was awkward, and I'm back to the comparing again. And when the season's over, or even when the game is over sometimes, I was back to comparing myself against other people. And, you know, I just couldn't get that to turn off, and I didn't even know it was on, because it was on all the time. I just lived like that. But I started off slow with drinking anyway. I didn't drink until I got to college. And prior to that, I judged people who drank because that was bad. And I didn't do things that were bad. I was a little bit of a goody two-shoes in that respect anyway. But I get to college and I meet these, great people. And, I figured everybody drinks in college, so I might as well do it now. And I came to college out here in D.C. But it started off slowly for me. But I'll tell you, the first couple times I drank, I didn't get drunk. I maybe only had one or two of whatever we were having. But I saw other people around me getting drunk, and I felt jealous. And I felt even worse than I did, just plain sober in real life before, because they were certainly getting something that I wasn't. And that just made me mad. And so I would try and act drunk, which was just made me even more heady, and it was not fun. Probably the third or fourth time I tried drinking, I had enough to get drunk. And I remember the effect. I remember it like it was yesterday. I was sitting on the floor of this dorm room, and I don't remember what we were drinking, but I started feeling more relaxed. And that constant clatter and chattering in my head had stopped. I didn't know where it went, but I wasn't worried about what people were thinking of me anymore, and I wasn't worried about whether, I was funny or not, or, how I looked, or I just stopped worrying about all that stuff instantly, through no effort on my part. And that was what I loved about drinking, because it gave you the satisfaction of a job well done without doing anything. And I thought, God, if I can get by, that in life, that's great, because I don't, I like the rewards of stuff, but I don't necessarily like the work that comes with it. And so I'll get upset, again with the comparing and contrasting, I used to get upset when somebody, close to me would get something because they worked hard for it, and, why can't I have that? So I felt the effects of alcohol, and it shut up my head, and I remember thinking, so this is why people drink. I get it now. And I guess looking back, it's not why everybody drinks. Probably is why we drink. But it changed everything for me. And again, retrospect, I couldn't have told you at the time. I just had a good time. Nothing bad happened. And, for the first year or so drinking, for the first couple of years, nothing bad happened. And, it was a slow start. But, by the end of college, the last couple of years, I'd had my set group of friends. And a lot of them, I mostly hung out with the rugby team because I was friends with them before, and also because they drink like fishes, and I love that. I can blend right in. And I just, took on, I was dating one of the rugby players, and I felt like I was everyone's kid sister, and they looked out for me, and I just had this, I always thought if I could live that year over and over again, maybe I wouldn't be here, because no consequences, Nope, no consequences. I don't want to lie. other than, like throwing up occasionally. But, nothing for an alcoholic like me. And that's really somewhere around there is when I started thinking about alcohol as more of a means to an end of getting drunk rather than something that you do socially. I always thought, soon after I started drinking, I didn't understand why people had a couple of drinks if they weren't going to get drunk, because that's why you drink. And, early on it was like, oh, that's a waste of money and calories. Why don't you just get a Diet Coke? But later on it was just, I had to drink because I had to drink. So college was great. It, a lot of good memories. And especially towards the end of drinking, like, that's what I thought about the most. It was reliving those good old days, and why can't I get there again? I have the same, the same people were still in my life on the periphery, because by then my friends had shut me out. I was like, every time I go out with my friends at the end, like, it was just awful. And I couldn't understand why I couldn't drink like I used to. It was so confusing. So that was fun. But then after college, things started getting worse. And I didn't know it, but my disease is progressive. I didn't know I had a disease. I had a roommate, and I lived with a guy friend of mine. A little while into it, I started hiding liquor in my room because I thought that You know, he would judge me if I had too many glasses of wine with dinner. And he would definitely judge me if he saw me drinking liquor on a Wednesday night. So we'll just hide it in my room, no big deal. And that's what I did for the first year after college. And, you know, essentially that's about when I started drinking on a daily basis. And that was in 02. And I didn't get sober till 06. You know, I thought, and that's also when things started happening. Like before, when I would drink, there was always somebody worse than me. There's always somebody passed out and somewhere in the corner with puke on them, and I was like, that sucks. But I don't think I was ever the one passed out in the corner with puke on them, but I was definitely the worst one. Somebody had to take care of me, and it was usually my husband. Back then, we were still dating, the rugby player guy. You know, that was fine when he was around, but, you know, later on in my drinking story, when he wasn't around, my friends just didn't want to deal with me because I was a liability at that point. So my drinking progresses. You know, I thought that when I moved in with my husband that, you know, I would stop doing the hiding thing because I knew that wasn't right. I knew it wasn't normal. I was pretty sure my roommate wasn't hiding liquor in his bedroom, but I just thought, well, you know, I deserve my drink after work, and, you know, one drink of wine, two drinks of wine isn't doing it for me, so I needed, you know, a couple drinks of, you know, vodka and Diet Coke. It's totally fine. And, you know, I didn't like my job, so I basically woke up and, you know, went to work and did my job, and then, and I was so thirsty at the end of the day, I could not wait to have that drink, and that was my reward. So that's how I saw it. It was perfectly fine. I'm just not going to tell anyone else about it because they won't understand. But when I moved in with my husband back when we were dating, I was like, okay, I know this isn't right. So first 3 weeks or so, I don't remember how long, I didn't have any liquor hidden, and I thought about it every day after work, and it just drove me crazy. And finally, I just broke down, bought some, and hid it in the closet, and continued doing that. And, you know, it was like one stiff drink, then two stiff drinks, and I would definitely, I had this little regimen where I would, you know, go to work, and then I usually got home before him, and I would go to the gym, and I would be hungry, but I would go to the gym because I knew that if I work out and then drink on an empty stomach, it's going to be awesome. And so that's what I did. I used to love drinking on an empty stomach. And so I would, you know, I'd work out, and then I'd go back to the apartment and shower and have a quick, you know, stiff drink while he was in the gym working out, and then I'd be good to go for the rest of the night, and then just have a glass of wine or two at dinner. And you know, I really felt like I wasn't harming anyone. It didn't matter, as long as nobody knows, it's fine, and it'll just work itself out somehow. But like I said, it's progressive, so it got worse. And then, you know, when I'm going out now, I'm drinking even more and starting to look like a fool, and that's not always fun. But still nothing too bad. And then, you know, we moved after that, and, you know, things seemed to get better for a period of time, and then they got worse. You know, at this a couple years after that, we were in San Diego, and my husband was in a grad school program there. And, you know, that was when things really started getting bad. I had a job for a month or so, a temporary job, and he was in school, and things were okay then, and we'd go out and party on the weekends. But then when that job ended, and I was looking for a, you know, career-type job, I didn't have any contacts, I didn't know anyone out there, and it was tough. And it never occurred to me to ask for help with that. That's something I've learned from AA. You know, because I had contacts in the industry I'm in who might know somebody in San Diego, I don't know, but it never occurred to me to ask. And so I would just keep putting my resume out there and keep getting resentful. And, you know, even my roommates had jobs, and they were potheads, so that really made me feel bad. You know, that's when I started drinking in the mornings because I thought at least it'll make the day better. And that's, you know, when you start drinking in the mornings, that's when things, it's hard to hide it sometimes. I mean, a couple of times my husband came home from school. One time for sure I know he came home from school and found me passed out in the bathroom with puke everywhere. And that was probably at like 7 o'clock at night. And, you know, it's one thing, I guess, if you do that on the weekend. But how do you explain that, you know, to somebody at 7 o'clock on a, you know, weekday night? I actually don't remember that, but that was what I was told the next morning. And I remember waking up in my bed and not knowing that I didn't get there by myself. And it's like, okay, what can I make up that sounds believable? How can I get out of this one? And that's, you know, the things that started happening while I was drinking, that was always the next thought. It was never, don't drink. That just, it never even occurred to me, honestly. It never, I mean, people would say it to me, and it wasn't an option. Because, at this point, drinking was more of a necessity and more of a, it was like a, not like a duty, but it was a necessity. I mean, it was still fun at that point, but, I drank with purpose. And, and certainly had to hide it a lot more. I mean, I got caught a couple of times in hiding it in the closet. So my solution was to then hide it in the bathroom because that has a lock on the door. And I didn't get caught after that. So I was like, awesome, I have my solution. And, or I hid it in the car. I just had all these little hiding places. Or I would, go for a drive, when I just needed to get out of the apartment because everybody was bothering me. And I would go down to the liquor store and get a couple of the little teeny ones. And then drive back, and you're waiting at a stoplight, and you unscrew it, and then you go down, and then you chug it, and then you come back up, and I was joking with people about that. We're like, we can't think of anybody who does that except people who are drinking in their cars. Why else would you have to do that? But, I don't know. And then, I'd find a dumpster and throw it away, and then I would be okay. I mean, when all else fails, just go for a drive and drink and come back and apologize in case I've acted rudely. So finally in San Diego, I ended up, I saw a psychologist or a psychologist there, after one of the, instances in which I did something wrong, with my drinking. All I did there was just complain about my relationship with my husband. We're still dating back then. And, because that's one of my tools for living are avoidance. Let's avoid it and pretend like it's not there. So you can't do that when you're at a psychologist. But I can turn it around on somebody else and make it their fault. So that's, that was what I did. If I can't ignore it, I'll just make it somebody else's fault. I can at least play the victim. You'll feel sorry for me. Just get off my back. And so that was how that went. And I saw him for a few months. I don't remember getting anything out of it because I didn't talk about my drinking. I lied the whole time. There's another part in the big book that talks about that too, and it just, they have me in there. So I belong. But moving on. So now, I got a job in the last few months working there, but my next escape and the next thing that was going to fix me was grad school. And this was for two reasons. One, because I needed a change, and that seemed like a good idea. It would get me out of San Diego, because San Diego's a problem. and I missed all my friends back in Maryland. So, and then the other part was, I said I couldn't be happy for other people. And my husband was unhappy with his grad school. He got into a really good one. He changed programs. And I was just so, I was jealous of that, honestly, and it angered me. And, I could not be happy for that guy, because he was getting all this attention, going to an Ivy League school. I was like, so I'm going to apply for grad school. I'm in Maryland, and that was in 2005 when I came back here, and that was just the speed up to the end, because for the first time since I'd crossed over that line into alcoholism, I was living by myself, and it was game on. I remember moving into that place and going, after everyone left, and I went down to I'd already staked out the liquor stores on the drive there, and I drove to the liquor store, and I got a big old thing of vodka, and put it in the fridge, and then immediately took it out and started drinking it, but then I put it back in the fridge, and it was just like, finally, I thought, I can put my vodka in the fridge like a lady, and, it seems very true to me, but, and that was just, it just sped up the end. I mean, I started school in August, I'm still drinking every day at night, but, and blacking out now on a regular basis, and, things were happening, and, I'd wake up knowing that I hadn't remembered going to bed, but I was living by myself, nobody knew, doesn't count. That was how I thought, and, a couple of months into, living by myself, I'm waking up with the shakes, and, I know the second time that happened, I was like, I know what fixes this. It's really like medicine, if you think about it. It's, I have a deficiency in alcohol level in me right now, so I just need to balance it out. It's not really like drinking in the morning. It's just, fixing the level. And that's what I told myself as I was pouring my vodka into my coffee. And, but that's when I started drinking in the morning. And for me, once I started that, I couldn't stop drinking in the morning. And so I started, carrying around a vodka Diet Coke bottle, half filled with vodka, half filled with Diet Coke, just to maintain strength throughout the day. And like I said, this is after like a month or two couple months into grad school. And classes for a while became more interesting after that, and then I stopped going. And at this point, you know, I've been to the hospital a couple times. One was for, I looked back on it when I was drinking. I was like, well, that wasn't technically for drinking because I cut my hand doing the dishes. And I still have the scar, and it kept bleeding and bleeding. And at this point, I hadn't been doing the drinking in the morning thing yet, but I hadn't started drinking yet that day because I like to reward myself. So I was like, you know, cleaning up the apartment and all that. And once I saw that cut, I mean, I know alcohol thins your blood, and I was like, it's not going to be good. So I waited an hour, and that was about as long as I could wait. And it had almost stopped bleeding by then. But then, you know, I start drinking, and it's hours later. It's still bleeding, and I finally call my boyfriend was still in town at that point, and I call him to come over and, you know, help me out. And I don't remember what happened between then and waking up in the bathroom. But I woke up in the bathroom. He's pounding on the front door. And I look down at myself. I've changed into my pajama bottoms. And there's, like, blood all over them. There's blood on the bathroom floor. And I walk out into the, you know, I lived in the efficiency, so the other room. And and there's, like, blood on the carpet. And I was like, oh, God. And I open the door. And at first he's like, didn't you hear me? I've been knocking here forever. And I was like, I was in the bathroom, which is true. and then he looks behind me. He sees the blood, and he's like, we're going to the hospital. So in my mind, I'm like, that wasn't for drinking. That was because I cut my hand. And then I remember the next week, and I bought some OxyClean, and I like to clean for a while. Like, I went through this, like, a period where I'd like to clean or do, like, artsy kind of projects when I would drink. And I still have this little flag that I made once. But anyway, so I bought some OxyClean and was, like, going to town all buzzed and drunk cleaning my blood from the weekend before. And I was like, this isn't bad. Anyway, so that was the first time. And then the second time I woke up in a gutter after getting dropped off by some people. I was downtown drinking in D.C. and some girls I didn't know but just met gave me a ride back to College Park, and I couldn't remember where I lived. And then so they just dropped me off at the university gates, which was across the street from the university police station. The next thing I remember, I'm literally in the gutter, like, looking up, and there's these cops there, and I can see an ambulance, and they're telling me they're putting me in there, and I'm like, whoa, 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 everything's okay, I feel fine, I live right over there, I'm just going to go home, but thank you. And they weren't having any of it. I even tried to offer them to take me home, because I thought that would appease them somehow, but I was just basically being, I wouldn't say a belligerent drunk because I was too worried about what other people thought about me, but I was definitely a stubborn one. And so they put me to the ambulance, and I had to make up this story the next day because, you know, I wake up in the hospital and I call the person I always call, my husband. We were engaged at that point. You know, I tell him I'm in the hospital, and by then I cooked up the story about what happened. The story was I got dropped off by these girls. They dropped me from the university police station, and I tripped and fell, and the policeman saw, and they insisted that I go to the hospital because I'd been drinking. Bits and pieces of truth in there, but certainly not the real story at all. But that was what I came up with. And that was basically, you know, I ended up in the hospital another time. You know, these things that started happening started getting closer and closer together. And I was basically, you know, I got drunk in an airport and missed a flight up to Connecticut for Thanksgiving to go spend it with my future in-laws. And I remember cutting the pie the next day, and I had the shakes. And I could see my future father-in-law was right there. And watching my hands shake, and I wished the floor would open up and just pull me in. I mean, I couldn't stand them knowing, you know, what could possibly be wrong with me. I couldn't stand anyone knowing. I was so afraid that people would find out a little bit of the truth, and that they would make me stop drinking. It wasn't so much, I mean, it's not like I was going out there and, like, deliberately trying to, you know, hurt people or cut people out of my lives. Like, calling my sister when I felt like it, and usually when I felt like it was when I was drunk. Things like that, or, like, calling on my parents the same way. Like, I never felt like doing anything unless I was drunk, or at least buzzed. I always jumped over that line. I was always just trying to get buzzed, but I usually ended up very drunk and then blackout. You know, so I wasn't trying to hurt people, and it bothered me that I did. It just didn't bother me enough. Because alcohol was more important. It just made me feel at the end, really, okay enough. In the beginning, it just made me feel awesome. And I drink. The reason I'm an alcoholic is because I can't control how much I drink, and I didn't understand that at first. I didn't understand that. I was like, what are you talking about? I reach out, and I pick it up, and I drink it. I mean, there's no, it's not like voodoo. But it was, you know, when I have one, that's, there's no such thing as one to me, unless there literally is not any more on the earth. You know, I can't just have one, because it lights up that fire inside me that wants more and more and more, and doesn't want to count and doesn't want to be accountable. And just, I want more, and, you know, I just want more. And normal people don't think like that. I remember my last New Year's drinking, and at this point, I had been not going out with my friends so much. I thought because I was making the decision to drink at home because then I don't end up in the hospital. But in reality, my friends had just stopped returning my phone calls and emails because they didn't know what to do with me. At this point, my, you know, husband's up in school and he's not around as much anymore. And, you know, I was just a liability when we went out. So the husband is down for New Year's Eve, so we get invited to this party. And I know that I'm, you know, kind of being watched and that people are wary of how I drink, which I thought was really annoying. My husband's like, why don't we do a beer an hour? Because that'll be fun. And nothing about that makes sense. You know, I'm screaming inside of me, but I cannot voice that because I know, like I said, I know there's something wrong with my drinking. I just thought it was okay for me. And I didn't know I was an alcoholic. I just thought I liked to drink a lot. And none of my friends do, apparently. And so I was being watched that New Year's Eve. I didn't get drunk. I remember one time being able to run into the kitchen when none of my friends, like good close friends, were around. And I ran into the kitchen because they were doing shots. And I was like, give me one, get like an animal, you know, give me a shot. And, you know, and I chugged that, I, you know, took it down. And I was just, it was an awful night. It was so awful. I mean, being around alcohol and not being able to get the effect from it was, it's, you guys know. And the next morning, you know, we woke up and we're chatting about the night, and I woke up angry, and just so mad that I had been robbed of a drunk New Year's Eve. And so my husband's like, wasn't that fun? You know, we didn't get that drunk. And, you know, I remember the night. You remember the night. And I wanted to slap him so much. I mean, he did not get it. And I just swallowed it all down and was like, yeah, it's great. Just, you know, and when he came to visit me on his breaks from school, I mean, it was, especially towards the end, it was awful for me. I'm sure it was awful for him too. But, I mean, you know, I remember one time we went to the hospital because he was having what we later found out was an anxiety attack. And, it happened on the same day he was going to leave on his train back up to Connecticut. And, you know, that was inconvenient for me because I was going to plan on drinking as soon as he left. And now it looks like he's going to miss his train. And, you know, no regard for, you know, that he's going through something like this and was scared. And, you know, I just was not showing up. All I was thinking about was how he was robbing me of my drinking time. He'd been here for a freaking week. You know, I've had to hide my liquor all this time and drink it while you're in the shower. I mean, can you just go? You know, some fiance, right? You know, and so we're in the hospital. And I can't believe, I mean, I even said, you know, don't you, this is before we got checked into the hospital, but I even suggested that, don't you think, you know, it would be better that you go on the train and go up to Connecticut and go to a hospital there. That way you're closer to your dorm room. And he's just like, no. And, you know, I mean, I was so selfish, absolutely selfish. And I got it, you know, funny how AA works, but I got a chance to kind of do something opposite like that after I got sober. But, I mean, you know, and so what I did is, you know, we stayed in the hospital, we went and did the hospital thing for a few hours and then came back and, you know, I said I was going to go for a drive and to clear my head. And I went and I got some more vodka and I, like one of those little, I don't remember what they're called, but the little ones you can fit in your purse. yeah, I drank about a third of it and I was like, okay, that'll get me at least through the rest of the night. And so by the time I drove back to the apartment, like it had started to take effect and I was like, look, I'm sorry for being so pushy earlier. I really apologize. And, you know, I couldn't even apologize sober. You know, I needed alcohol to do everything. So eventually what happens is I get a DUI, and I even thought at the time that was a raw deal. But you know, considering how many times I drank and drive before, like, you know, going to the grocery store to get munchies, or sometimes, you know, when I was really wallowing in my self pity for being alone and having no friends, I made this CD called Sad Songs, and I would pop it in my car and take a little vodka with me and just drive around the neighborhood listening to it. And I reveled in my misery, especially at the end, because I felt so alone. And I really, you know, I'd started thinking about suicide, and I had this idea about how to do it, but I didn't want to make it look like suicide, so I was going to drive my car into a tree, but I knew that they would find, you know, if I did it, I had to sober up first, because otherwise it would look like a drunk driving accident, because I couldn't do that to my parents. I could die, but I just couldn't, you know, have my parents think I committed suicide or was driving drunk. But then, you know, since I can't stop drinking because I'm drinking all the time, because it's easier than just thinking about it all the time, you know, I can't get sober to do that. So that was going to be the plan eventually. But I did get a DUI, and this is when I was driving, this Easter weekend, driving from Maryland up to Connecticut to go spend it with my in-laws. And I just have bad times when I try and make trips up there, at least when I'm drinking. And I made it. I started out Friday night because I've been drinking through the night at that point, and so I slept a few hours, and I started out like at 6 or 7 o'clock, and made it as far as close to the Maryland-Delaware border. When I followed this detour sign, because I thought that there was something going on with 95 North or whatever. And long story short, I'm on the side of a road, like trying to look at a map, and this cop comes up, and you know, he asks if I'm okay, and I immediately start crying, because that's what I do. And I told him, oh, I'm on antidepressants, I'm a little weird right now, sorry, and which was true. I had started seeing another psychologist who then recommended antidepressants, because I was telling them I'm waking up every day and feeling unmotivated until I drink. You know, but I didn't tell them that, and so they prescribed me antidepressants. And this psychiatrist asked me once, he was like, well, how much do you drink? And I don't know why, but I kind of felt like being a little bit honest. So I was like, well, if I go out all night, like 9 beers, I thought that sounded, that's like a beer an hour if you go out all night, I thought that sounded okay. And he's like, that's too much. And that was the end of me ever being remotely honest about that. So anyway, here I am talking to this cop, and what he does, this is Friday night, is he's like, well, you can't drive anymore. Go get a hotel room and leave your car here and don't get it before 10 a.m. So I do that. I drink some more in my hotel room, and then I'm off on the road the next day at 10 a.m. And this time I make it as far as northern New Jersey, and I am going through one of those easy pass turnstiles, and my car tire catches on the curb on the way out. And it breaks or bursts or whatever. I get a flat tire. And it was, looking back, this is like the safest ever DUI, maybe, for me. The safest way it possibly could have happened, because I'm already going like a mile an hour when it happens. So I just kind of pull over. And I'm trying to figure out how to, you know, use the jack and all that. I now know how to do it, but I didn't then. And, you know, I, of course, call my husband and tell him what's going on. And, you know, I don't know how much vodka I had left. At this point, I just had the Diet Coke bottle. No Diet Coke, just vodka. In the little driver's cup thing, and a full one of Diet Coke and vodka in my bag, Diet Coke bottle with vodka. In my bag behind me, and so maybe 5 or 10 minutes later, a cop comes along, and I was like, oh, good, he's going to help me change the tire. We talked for about 10-ish minutes, I think. That's what I was told later. And because about 10 minutes into the talk, he starts asking me questions that don't have to do with my car, and I start getting a little worried because I've been drinking around the clock. And he asked me if I had anything to drink the night before. I was like, oh, a couple beers, and which we all know is not true. And so then he makes me do the roadside sobriety test, and that's when I really fail. And he, you know, hauls me in and puts the handcuffs on me and puts me in the back seat. And at that point, I finally was out of excuses. You know, I couldn't manipulate my way out of handcuffs. I had never pictured myself in handcuffs, and I was at a loss for words as to how I could explain this one away. I mean, I can explain the hospital trips away and lie about that, but when there's police reports involved, I can't really make it up and get away with it anyway. And I just didn't, I'm crying, I'm blubbering. I felt like I just didn't know what to do. I was at the turning point. I, you know, had nowhere else to go. And so they gave me a lot of time. You know, my mother-in-law had to drive down from Connecticut to then get my husband and then get me in New Jersey and then drive back up. And I remember, at that point my husband called my parents and told them what was going on and said that, you know, she needs to go to rehab or we're done. And so I agreed to go to rehab. and mostly because I thought it would be a good break. It would dry me out. And then I could go back to drinking like how I'd been drinking in college. Because I thought the problem was that I'd just been drinking so much and I couldn't get off of alcohol. And if I just had a dry spell, then we could go back to how we were. And it would make me look like I was actually trying to change. Because I did want to change. I just didn't want to have to do it myself because that would be too hard. So now I'm in rehab, and finally I meet other people like me, other alcoholics. And, you know, I've been going on, I felt so alone, especially in the last year with my drinking. Just all the lies and juggling and trying to, cry or manipulate my way. And just, I thought I was a good girl who just, you know, drank too much. I found out later I was not. I don't remember what the guy's name was or what he's doing now, but I remember the first person I talked about hiding his vodka. And I was floored. I mean, it's funny because we talk about that stuff all the time here. And, you know, and I forget sometimes that that's a big deal to somebody who's brand new, who's never, you know, been to an AA meeting before, never really talked about their drinking before, and just to throw it out there. I mean, it was earth-shattering to me, honestly. And it was that kind of stuff that helped start break down the wall that I've been building up over those years of just feeling alone and feeling wrong and feeling judged, but still just wanting to do it my way and hoping that nobody noticed too much. And and in that rehab, I actually got a lot out of rehab. I feel it because I was ready, and I was just, like I said, I was done. I had nothing else to, you know, do or say or anything. And I thought that, you know, I might as well listen while I'm here because I know it costs money. So, they brought in meetings every day. We did a couple meetings a day and alcoholism learning and that kind of stuff. And I remember when they did the smoking is bad for you lesson, everyone, like, went outside and lit up with relish afterwards. It was really funny. But I actually got a lot out of it. And in the sense that it did dry me up for 28 days. And I learned actually what AA is. And so when I got ANS, most importantly for me, I lost the obsession to drink. It went away somewhere in a couple of weeks. And I noticed one day when I was having a rough time with some rehab drama that I, you know, something, a problem had occurred, and I had actually thought about a, like, logical solution to it, you know, like talking to a counselor. And I didn't think about drinking. And actually, I hadn't been thinking about drinking. And something was different. Meeting other alcoholics who were, you know, telling me about themselves. There were actually a lot of relapsers with, like, double-digit years in there, too. And so they were telling me all about AA and DC and blah, blah, blah. And I'd become very interested. And without that, when the obsession was removed, I actually had room to really hear and start thinking, maybe I am one of these people. And they told me to find myself in the big book, and I thought that meant flipping to the back and reading the stories and trying to find one like yours. And I eventually found myself when I was reading the first time I found myself was when I was reading the third chapter, and it says the obsession of every alcoholic is to one day be able to control and enjoy his drinking. And I thought, oh, my God, they have my number. That's what I've been doing. And then later on it says, you pursue this into the gates of insanity and death. And then after that it says, you know, if you're like this, you're doomed. And I thought, oh, God, I really can't drink anymore because I relate to these people so much. And so I come out of rehab, and I start going to meetings. And I came out on a Sunday night, and I tried to find this. I went to this one meeting that was near my place, and I couldn't find it. And I felt like I completely failed at AA. I'm such a loser. But I went the next night, and this girl about my age came up to me and introduced herself, and just, you know, she did what alcoholics do. She stuck out her hand, offered to take me to a meeting where people our age, and I was like, really? And so she takes me to this meeting, and there's a lot of people my age, and not just, You know, I thought AA was, you know, people who were my grandfather's age who, you know, sat around talking about how, you know, how good it was and how crappy it is now, and just really boring. And like I said, I thought it was a death sentence. But here are people that are my age and, like, sunny and happy, and that confused me, but it really attracted me. And these people were so active. I mean, they were on me to, like, hang out before meetings, hang out after meetings. You know, we're doing this on the weekend. And I was like, back off. I already have friends, even though I haven't talked to them in, like, 4 or 5 months. You know, so I just, it's funny. I recently celebrated at a meeting, and this guy who's got a lot of years came up to me, and he's like, you know, that's better than, you know, being silent in my beach house for the entire weekend. And I just didn't talk much when I was new. I went to the beach once with a group of people, and I don't remember saying much other than talking to my sponsor about how much, you know, I didn't like being at the beach. And that was, you know, when I was new, I mean, I would sit and listen to people and just think about how I'm not like that. But I would still relate, and something kept drawing me back. And, you know, and I met my sponsor, and, you know, she also had a husband who was not an alcoholic, too. And, you know, that is, I mean, that has helped tremendously. I'm really grateful for that. And I found in AA that, you know, people's experience really does matter. And, you know, I don't have to figure out something on my own. Like, I'd always kind of rolled before in life. Like, pull myself up by my bootstraps, I'll figure it out. That's how I thought I would stop drinking so much, and obviously it didn't work. But that can apply to life, too. I mean, why do I need to, you know, go out and, you know, mess something up with my thinking when I can just hear somebody else's experience on it? It's a lot easier. But that took time for me. But, you know, the first year of sobriety was, it sounds cheesy, but it was truly a gift. You know, I got to start working on those living amends with my husband. And, you know, we began planning our wedding. And, you know, that was just a whole other journey. And, you know, another time, you know, I mentioned that time that he ended up in the hospital when I was drinking. He got food poisoning once. And this is, I think I had, like, I don't know, 6, 7, 8, 9 months. And, you know, there was going to be this AA event that night, and we couldn't go to it now. And I was really upset. But I knew at this point I got enough clarity to know that I can't be upset at him that he has food poisoning and we're not going to go to the event. Because that's what I would do. If I was mad, I would just dump it on you until you felt bad with me. Anyway, so we're at the hospital, and it's the hospital, one of the hospitals where I was at twice when I was drinking, and I think I see the same cop and same German Shepherd dog that was there one time when I was drinking, and I tried to talk to the dog, and it was just, I was like, ah, you know, but I knew I wanted to be present. I knew that this was a chance to make living amends, and you know, so we get them in there, and, you know, they're doing some stuff on them. So I step out and make some phone calls until I find somebody who's not at the AA event. And she talks to me, and I'm able to breathe. And I go back in there, and I be of service. And, you know, he thanked me later for it, and I just felt like, something is different here. You know, it never would have occurred to me to ask somebody for help before. Honestly, I just did not do that because I thought I got to explain it the way that makes me look the best, so you can tell me what I want to hear. And that might not work too. So I might as well just not even try. So, you know, and one of the things I was scared about when I got sober was that I'm not going to be able to drink at my wedding. And I'd open bar. I mean, I've been to more weddings sober than I have drunk now, which is probably a good thing, but still. you know, and so I was really upset about that, and I thought it was a big deal, but it turns out, you know, not only, you know, did I not have to drink, it was probably one of the best days of my life. And, you know, getting married part's awesome too, but it wasn't just that. It was, you know, the months of help I had from my, you know, my pigeon sisters and my friends who helped me plan it, and who helped me, who just showed up, I mean, crazy showed up for me for that. And, you know, I really felt like finally I have this network of people that I can actually rely on, and I can actually be honest with and open with. And, you know, I did go through a rough spot there when I thought that I just had all this stuff going on, and I wasn't asking for help with it. And people would ask me, do you need help? Do you need help? I'm like, oh, I'm good, because in my mind it was stupid little nitty-gritty stuff. But today, I mean, that's the stuff that really gets my goat. I mean, the big problems come, and it's like, whoa, obviously I need to, you know, ask for some help on this. But the little stuff, I'm like, I got it. But I didn't have it, and I burst into tears at the end of this one meeting after somebody asked me how I was doing. And And he tells me that, you know, he gives me a hug and tells me to call my sponsor, so I do, and we just break it down, and we go to town on the stupid nitty-gritty stuff. And that day turned out to be one of the best days of my life. It was an opportunity for me to show up for my parents, they flew out from California, and I remember my college, another one of these, like, chance to change things. My college graduation, I had really been kind of selfish with them, and I don't have a picture of me with them on the day I graduated college. They probably have one, but it was just about me and my friends, and I know that was hurtful to them. And so, you know, when I graduated grad school, I really, you know, did my best to make it about them, and we took tons of pictures, and I made my mom this little mug with us on it, but again, when they came out for my wedding, it's like, it's a real pain in the butt sometimes when people not in AA are like, it's your day, you know, blah, 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 and I was like, shut up. It is not my day, but, you know, thank you. You guys need a drill. I mean, it is not about me. It is about my family, and that's, you know, that was the mantra going in, and I absolutely had the best time. And I've been able to, you know, start to realize my career dreams in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I remember the day I interviewed for that job, I could feel the presence of AA because the guy interviewing me had this question, like, where do you see yourself in 10 years or something like that, or where do you see your career going? And I thought about it, and I was honest. And I realized that it doesn't matter necessarily what I do, but as long as I'm happy doing it, I'd like it to be this, but as long as I'm happy doing it, then that's what I want to do. And I'm a writer now. And he looked at me, and he's like, you know, it takes most people a lifetime to figure that one out. And I knew that that was Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, I don't come up with something like that. I don't have that ability to, like, look at myself and really know the answer to that question unless I'm doing the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. My sponsor began working me through the steps pretty immediately because I was living with my husband, and there was a lot of damage there, as you are well aware. But just living amends, one of the hardest things for me is to not, like I said, not to say things to make you feel bad because I'm bad. I go on the defensive. I mean, I had to call my sponsor a week or so ago about something, you know, this text message exchange I had, I felt like I was wrong, even though I'd done something wrong too. But all I can see is, you know, the other person's part. And I need an outside voice who I trust implicitly and unconditionally to be able to show me the truth. I'm able to trust her because, you know, I've done a fourth step with her, or fifth step, and I've done an eighth step. I almost said ninth. But I've been able to, you know, a sponsor has helped me, you know, look at myself, see the wreckage of my past, and be able to start clearing that up. Because if I don't know what's wrong with me, if I don't know the tools that I have for living that I brought into AA and that have gotten me that far, then how am I supposed to be able to change and start using AA's tools? I need to know what I'm putting down in order to pick up something else. And so doing that, you know, being able to see my character defects, I finally understood what selfishness and self-centeredness was after I did my fifth step, because I thought it was people who, just look in the mirror a lot or go shopping or are really vain, and that's not it at all for me. I mean, thinking about what other people think of me. How do I look? Do I look bad? And that was how I'd been living before I got to AA. I mean, everything about how I was living is, what can I do today that makes me look like I'm functioning? And I would, you know, that would either be go to work or go to school, sometimes both, but really not towards the end. Or I don't even know what else I did. Because I skipped class a lot or called in sick from work or wanted to work from home. And I really thought that people didn't know. I was absolutely the last one to find out. And when I told my close college friends that I was going to rehab, they were like, good. good. I've been around, because I have friends that do drink, you know, I've been around them on occasion when it's, you know, when I'm in a good fit spiritual condition and when I have a good reason for being there, mostly weddings. I've been able to have a good time. And one of my friends, Tom, at the last wedding we were at, we were dancing, and he's like, you know, Liz, I like you a lot better sober than I did, you know, drunk. And I was just like, thank you. 'Cause me too, honestly. you know, I'm able to show up for those people who I just, you know, tornado through their lives now. And they've actually showed up for me. They came to my last celebration. It just absolutely floored me how, you know, they say more will be revealed. And I didn't realize maybe how aware they were of how bad I was. And, you know, just seeing how truly joyful they were that I had gotten, you know, that I was sober and that I was celebrating, and that I had this whole host of friends around me that supported me, and, you know, who I can lean on too, and they lean on me, and they were really happy for me. And I didn't really, I guess before I just thought it was, oh, we're happy for you, you know, good job, but they really, like, really are happy for me. And I just didn't realize that before. It didn't occur to me, I guess, that they would want to be part of something like that. But it's just, it makes me feel humble that, you know, I have friends like that, because I certainly wasn't that kind of friend to them. And I try to be now. And, you know, I've been able to make a lot of amends now, both living amends, in order for me to change. I have to start taking different actions, because my thoughts never follow my emotions, or follow my, you know what I'm talking about. my feelings never follow, or first, my feelings always follow my actions. So, the most recent amends I made was with my father-in-law, and that started, I guess, about a year ago. And my sponsor, I made amends to my mother-in-law, and it was amazing. And she's just an example of unconditional love to me. She's an amazing woman. And then so right after that, I wanted to make amends to my father-in-law. I was like, yes, let's go. And my sponsor's like, how would you do it? And I couldn't think of anything other than, like, you know, oh, if we run into each other drinking coffee in the morning next time I'm up visiting. I mean, it was complete BS. So, but anyway, so what she suggested I do is start calling the house, calling them once a week. And I was like, I don't know, what are we going to talk about? I mean, my father-in-law is not that much of a talker, not much at all, kind of like how I was when I first got sober. And, you know, so I was like, that's going to be awkward. But I did it anyway, because I do want to make amends to this man. And, you know, so we started doing that. And at first it was like me and my mother-in-law. And then Bob would, like, jump in every now and then, or not jump in. I'd ask him a question, honestly. And then, you know, but a couple of times, like, I've called and it was just him there. And, you know, we'd talk and talk. And, you know, a couple months after I started calling, you know, we went up to visit, and my husband was traveling from a different location than me, and so we were flying into different airports. And so the parents split up to pick us up, and Bob said he'd pick me up. And I, like, a few months before that, I would have been like, oh my God, what are we going to talk about? It's going to be our car ride. It's going to be so awful. But already the change had started, and, you know, so I was really excited about that. And I guess last month, we did a whole family trip up to Maine. And the first couple of plans I had for making amends didn't work out, but I was finally able to sit down with him and, you know, tell him why I was doing what I was doing, and tell him my part, and, you know, ask if there's anything I could do to make it right. And, you know, it went exactly how, you know, my sponsor and I thought it would. He listened politely, and he's like, you know, he had nothing to say. He's just, I always thought you made meaning my husband, you know, better person anyway. That's all he said. And, you know, and if I was writing the script, it wouldn't have gone that way. It would have been, like, blubbery and, you know, very emotional, and he finally would have opened up. And but I just needed to let him know. I just needed to let him know that I knew I had a part, and that, you know, I'm trying to live differently today. And I know he knows that. But I also needed to sit down and tell him that. And, you know, the blubbery emotional amends was my own dad. That was that was probably the most dramatic, I guess. It wasn't, I mean, in my head anyway. It was just very heartfelt. And, you know, I'm just so grateful to be able to sit down with people and look them in the eye after I've been living differently. And I truly do feel like a different person today. Although my character defects are still, like, dancing around back here, and sometimes they kind of come up here, but, you know, I have enough separation from them that I'm able to, I know what I do. I, you know, call my sponsor, you know, get busy helping other people, and keep talking to my higher power, because that is, those three things, that they just keep me sober today, at least for today. And I guess with that, thanks for letting me speak.